that was not an intro.
You sound like you like just woke up.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
You want to do a real countdown?
Sure.
Okay,
ready?
Do it.
Why do we sound different today?
No pop screens?
Maybe it is. Maybe it's the lack of the poppy filters.
Could be.
Count it down.
Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's a descendant.
Welcome to Staff Show Here Today, podcast number 20. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Tom, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Staff Show Here Today, and on Twitter at Staff Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Podbay. Let's talk about stamps. This week we'll be focusing on stamp news. There's been a lot of it. We're going to talk about Stamp Expo, and also the recent episode of Storage Wars. So let's start with the Ameristamp Expo 2015.
That's okay. I was going to comment on it because I always call it
Ameripex.
Yeah, and for me it was like every time somebody was talking about Ameristamp, I'm going, oh, I got to remember to say that correctly. So I totally sympathize.
Cash's corrections.
Yeah, Cash's corrections. If I use Ameripex throughout this thing, I mean Ameristamp, and I'm sure I'll use it.
Okay, so anything come to mind about Ameristamp Expo?
Yeah, I drove there in my new car.
That's stamp-related.
Oh, okay.
It seemed pretty busy.
I thought it was very, very busy, especially on Friday and Saturday.
I missed out on Sunday, but for Friday, it seemed like it was awfully busy. Saturday seemed even more so.
Well, I had trouble seeing a lot of dealers because they were always busy. There were always one or two people at almost every dealer's table throughout the entire day on both Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, but on Saturday, it was a zoo. I mean, it was just...
Oh, yeah.
It was incredible.
There was a lot of people there.
Yeah.
It was good to see.
This was the youngest group I've ever seen at a stamp show.
Yep.
Well, I told you the young friends of the APS were going to be there, and they showed up, and a bunch of them came that I didn't expect to see. So that was good, too.
All those youngsters with their...
Yeah, all those youngsters.
Riding their bicycles with the big front wheels and...
Oh,
get off my yarn!
Your yarn?
And my yard.
Your yawn?
Get off my yard. That was a cross between yard and lawn.
I thought you took up crocheting in your old age or something.
Are there any exhibits that stood out?
I think that Mr. Hotchner did a fantastic, non-competitive, but a really, truly fantastic exhibit. It was big, but, well, let me think. It was like 8 frames, and each frame has 16 pages in it. But every page, it wasn't about anything. He had like 8 frames, and every page had an individual story about something. Half of them, you know, I'm kind of like an advanced collector, and half of them were really interesting to me, and my girlfriend was there, and all of them were interesting to her. It was just really great because they didn't get into the weeds. They didn't, you know, talk about per varieties and engraving varieties and stuff, except when it actually was a story to it. And so he did a great job. I really enjoyed that exhibit.
Well, on the expert side, I enjoyed Greg Schultz's exhibit on rotary press coils. And there's some absolutely fabulous pieces in there. And it's all about how they were made. And it also talks about the rotary press coil waste and how those were made and why they were made and all sorts of real interesting things like that. So I enjoyed that exhibit from an expert standpoint very, very much. And especially because even if you don't want to be an expert in coils specifically, he had pictures of actual perforating and printing equipment that was used. And when you're trying to understand how stamps were made so that you can tell the difference between some of these really rare varieties, it helps to be able to visualize how they were made as well. And so that it makes it a lot easier to understand what you should be seeing when you look at them versus what you are seeing sometimes.
I'm surprised no one brought up the giant cockroach exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was your favorite?
Well, it scared the crap out of me.
Well, did you notice there were four empty frames there?
Did some get out?
No, I think that I think that was the chicken stamp exhibit that didn't make it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, but they had a real live, not live, it was alive, but a specimen that was mounted professionally in a, I don't know, professional mounted cockroach.
Carrying case.
Gigantic, larger than life. And I just wanted to squish it.
Mm. Well, I also heard some discussion about virtual exhibits where they set up a computer and the exhibit is shown as a progression of images on the screen, and so that the actual material isn't at the show, just the virtual exhibit.
Yeah, but that doesn't count.
Well, they've, but they were talking about that and possibly making it either a non-competitive area or, I mean, obviously sometime in the future they may go in that direction, but I don't know if I really would like that because I like seeing the actual items.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, a lot of these items are extremely rare.
I wonder if there is, it would be interesting if there was like some, maybe on the computer even, some website you could go to that showed videos of stuff.
Well,
you
I
know,
do.
Like one that maybe you could call, you know, you could call it TubeView or something like that.
Well, I
maybe
do know.
Maybe YouTube. That's a good name for it.
I do know that the APS requests all of their exhibitors at all of the APS sanctioned exhibitions. They request all their exhibitors to submit digital scanned copies of their exhibits. Very, very few do, but they do always request that, yeah. And the APS does make those available on their website.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys want to move on to Storage Wars? We're going to play a little bit of an interview we did right after we recorded Storage Wars, and then follow that with discussion about the episode after it aired. It's time to send up. So Steve's here to join us about a little experience he had on one of our favorite shows of all time, Storage Wars. So Steve, who came to join you from that show?
It was Dave Hester, the villain.
Yup. Sorry, couldn't resist. I love
that. Going, yup.
And he drove in his Yup van.
The Yup Mobile.
He most certainly did. As I was climbing the stairs, I turned and saw the vehicle come in. He was back in, and I turned and waved at him. He waved back. Didn't seem like he was that bad of a guide.
Okay, the part I'm curious about that I want to hear is how did this all start? How did it happen to begin with?
I got a few emails from a producer named Bitten from the Storage Wars program, and she asked if I would be interested in doing any review or appraisal reviews for the program, and I said, sure.
Was she the woman that was here?
No, that was Sarah.
Okay, Sarah.
Well, Sarah was I'll have nice. To tell you, having the production crew come in here, it was my first time dealing with a TV show. And the production crew, the film crew, they were all very, very nice, very accommodating, very polite, and easy to work with. What? And Dave Hester wasn't that bad either.
No, he was nice.
Oh, we're going to shatter his
the villain.
Bad boy.
Yeah, his bad boy persona.
Dressed
he was
in black.
Really nice.
Yeah, spoiler alert, if you want to hate Dave Hester, turn off the podcast right now.
Well, yeah. but his favorite people weren't here to wind him up either.
Yeah, so. That's true. But so. I got his autograph. PSE got his autograph. Jeff got his
too.
Autograph.
Evidence that he was here.
And we got a picture of him.
Yeah, he was really cool about it. He wasn't annoyed at all. We'd asked for autographs once, then Cash had to leave in the middle of taping, and he went, do you think you could ask him for one more? I felt like a seventh grader at a concert. Mr. Hester, could you sign one more, please?
Yeah, but you forget, you weren't bidding against him, so
yeah,
know,
it's there like, you go.
That's true.
He was out of his element, maybe.
Anyway, why don't you tell us your where they got you, or excuse me. Just keep talking.
I think they got me from online. I advertise on many places across the country and have a website. And I believe they may have got it from appraisers or through the APS even, which is the American Philatelic Society. So it's
so you because I know you've reached out to other shows in the past. So you didn't reach out to them.
Sure. No, I did not reach out. But I also do reviews for the Pawn Stars program.
Well, that's the one I was specifically thinking of.
Maybe there was something in conjunction with that, but they're separate entities, and there's, I don't think, any affiliation other than they're on the same network, which is 120 A&E.
Mm-hmm. It must just be close proximity, because Dave was asking, he was here, he's all, hey, how's that Japanese place downstairs from you guys? Is that any good? Kind of looked at him, huh? Because I see that all the time when I'm driving around, and I always wonder, I want to eat there. So he's definitely very local. He said he grew up here, didn't he?
Well, yeah.
He was referencing Santa Ana from the 60s.
Yeah, no, he grew up in Santa Ana.
Well, he's up his storage area. He doesn't have an office anywhere. Well, he's got an office. His storage area, he advertised it and everything. It's right up on Main Street, about a mile from us.
So not far. Huh.
Yeah. And then his store used to be across the freeway of where I used to live over on Newport Boulevard.
Well, I hope he finds more stamps and storage lockers so we can review them again.
Oh, yeah.
He said he would absolutely love to come back. So
what was in those big, old boxes that he brought in?
That smelled bad.
It didn't seem promising. Some of it was damaged by water or mildew, but it was a great selection of Ryukyu Islands that was in original packaging, and a lot of the envelopes had never been opened for more than 50 years. They were sent from Joseph Bush, who was a military person in Japan or Ryukyu Islands, and got the material firsthand. It was quite interesting because there was varieties and things like that. No early material, though, but it was fun to open envelopes like getting a lottery ticket. You know, you never know what's going to be in next. So it was fun for all of us.
You said there were a couple of neat sets in there, didn't you?
Yeah, there were also a couple of the first Luxembourg Europa sets on first day covers. There was a set of three on a pristine clean individual covers, and then there was a registered cover with the set intact. Normally we get all the cheapy common ones, and there were the two best one, or the best one in two different sets. So
yeah,
well, that's cool. Anything else in there? There were three boxes.
Because I'm sure they're not going to go again. We're recording this before it's on the channel, so we don't. You know, they're probably going to edit you down to like 5 minutes.
Yeah, 3 hours of taping, and most will be left on the cutting room floor.
Yep,
which is okay. Maybe it gets archived. There was also an 80-cent diamond head plate block, which I like is C46, and that actually transported a live orchid in a box from Hawaii to the mainland. So there's a nice joke in the program, which I think they're going to include. So look forward to that.
Cool. Yeah, it was really cute. The producer, well, I don't know, was she director? The woman that was here.
Director.
She's a director. She came out twice going, yeah, there's more here than we thought. We're going to be another. First time she said 20 minutes. Then she said she didn't know how long the second time.
Well, when they broke the time before I left, because I had to leave, they said, yeah, we're starting on the third box. I'm going, you know, under normal appraisal circumstances, how long would it have taken you to look through that box, those boxes?
Hour, maybe max.
Yeah, and that's going through everything. And this was 3 hours. I mean, they wanted everything.
That means they had you look through each box three times.
Yeah.
No. We didn't open every envelope either. It just, when we found a little vein, they wanted to see it more carefully and make sure that it was brought to the attention to the public in case they, you know, include it.
It was really cute. Again, the whole production crew was awesome. But
it was a lot of fun.
I think there was an assistant director here with the director. There was a guy, and he said he had done pre-production research on what was in the box. And the thing he thought was really cool that he wanted you to look at and I had to keep from laughing out loud, is he had a stack of, they're like first day covers, but the stamp is like a 24 karat gold plate or 18 karat gold plate. And he thought those were just the shiznit. And I'm sitting there going, buddy, I've got 20 of those you can have for $5.
$100 a piece, they're yours.
Yeah. I have like 2,500 of those at home right now.
They're gold. They have to be worth something.
But
they
on
are.
The other hand, the
they are.
I had a Marilyn
piece.
Monroe gold stamp, and that one sold for $25.
Yeah, there's three or four. Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, and the Star Wars. Those are all popular.
Yep.
And they carry value. The rest of them average about $1 a piece.
Yep.
All I know is nobody wants my stack of C3s. Nobody cares.
That's the one they sent out as the promo. That was a gift. Okay. They didn't even charge for that one.
Wow. So that literally is worthless.
They give those to introductory level people who want a C3A. They can't afford one.
That's funny. Now I know I have so many of them.
Mm-hmm. Everyone received one of those free.
Wow.
In their solicitation.
Huh. Wow.
It was a fun film, though.
It was.
And I got some souvenirs at the end.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I go, God, you know, I sure would like something that was on TV. And I was wondering, you know, if I went down and tried to buy something out of the box or something, and I looked in my trash can. They filmed in my office. They filmed on my conference table. And inside of my trash can, there were two envelopes of stuff from the boxes that, you know, were terribly mildewed and ugly. Oh, Steve is pointing to himself. He threw them away.
I told him that.
And it was great because, first of all, I found like a little pair of New Zealand stamps on a torn piece of paper. And I go, oh, I've got a souvenir. And then I open it up and I've got like 20 souvenirs.
Yeah, afterwards I thought about it. Says, maybe I should bought the three cartons because as seen on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at the
Dave Hester collection.
At the pawn shop, the items that have been brought into.
Oh, absolutely.
Are they embellish the price to, I want to say, moon prices.
Yeah.
You know, they say it's worth $500, and then when they price it for $3,000, as seen on TV.
Yes.
Oh, we were wondering how long something lasts once it hits the show. They probably have calls the moment it airs. Somebody wants to buy it. I wouldn't doubt it.
Groupies, yeah.
But it was really it was funny because Cash is actually lucky that he found those. We watched Jessica and Scott and I were left when they wrapped up. And Dave is a very clean person, too. He actually picked up the trash himself, had a trash bag, and hand-walked the trash in the trash bag out to the trash can.
Oh, that was nice.
So he cleaned up after himself. So the fact that those didn't end up in the bag that Dave threw out, a little extra bonus.
I told them they were over there, but I said they're nasty.
Yeah, they were nasty. I soaked them in
the bleach or whatever.
They got a two-day peroxide bath.
They got a really good bath because they were really bad.
You have Storage Wars contraband?
I have Storage Wars contraband.
They left it, but they left it on purpose. I did bring it to their attention that it was there.
Oh, okay.
So.
Oh.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time something has fallen out of a stamp collection, that's for sure.
Yeah, maybe I'll contact them back and say, you know, maybe I'd be interested in buying it.
You know. Well, just email them.
I will.
Yeah.
No, he might have his own way of selling it off once it goes in the show.
Yeah,
oh, I want to keep part of it now.
It's just going to end up in the
one
shop.
Buy one of the three boxes. Yeah, go down to his shop. It's probably on the shelf somewhere.
I'll contact him.
Well, I personally couldn't really care whether it was on the show or not, but if it's kind of neat, then if it's something I would normally want, then I would
The most intriguing part of it was that the majority of it was Ryukyu Islands, and I specialized that as a preteen and teenager and exhibited it for competition. And so it brought back a lot of memories. So it was fun going through, especially the unopened envelopes. You never know what you're going to find next, just like the box of chocolates. You never know what's inside.
It's just like on the show when they open up the storage units and you see stacks of boxes. I mean, it's the same kind of rush.
I would be Dave Mentor's nemesis if I was a bidder.
Oh, I can't do non-searched dealer boxes. I go nuts. somebody brought some to one of your local shows. And, okay, he talked to me into it. I'll take a look. 10 minutes later, I'm trying to decide which of 20 boxes I actually want to buy.
You got
sitting there going, oh my God, I want it all. That's cool. That's in there.
Can How much for all of them?
Yeah. And I got a good box.
Expensive really fast.
Yeah, for so much stuff you get. Tom got a nice box out of them. I got a nice box. Yeah, there's a lot of rush that goes with that.
Some inside. What did you value it at? Just curious. The three moldy boxes.
A place, as they say, we place a value of approximately $4,000 on it.
Now, what would it actually? What would it actually worth?
Is it going to show up on the show as $4,000?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what the show announcer how he phrases it.
I hope it's the biggest score of that show.
Oh, it's got to be $4,000. But I didn't see the whole thing. But
Dave Hester wins with a stamp collection valued at $4,000.
Dave Hester mailed in a win with a stamp collection at over $4,000.
No, he stamped out a win.
Yeah.
There you go. Start a pool on what the announcer is going to say.
Start stamping, guys.
It obviously wasn't $4,000. I mean, you would never get $4,000 for that.
Not I.
Yeah, he probably will. He'll see as on TV.
That's what I thought about afterwards, as seen on TV.
Yeah, yeah.
I have just made extra value to a lot of modern common items, but they added up. They do add up.
Oh, yeah.
The most expensive item was about $150. There was one postal card reply card unit that was $150.
Well, the Europa first day cover you said from Luxembourg.
$100 on that, and
well, $75 to $100. Yeah,
$75 for the set and $100 for the registered cover. You know, as far as the retail value.
Yeah,
yeah. They have a catalog value higher than that, but realistic. Yeah.
The director paid you the highest compliment. She's like, you know, sometimes you bring people the stuff and they're like, oh, yeah, I don't know what that is. And then they bring these boxes to an expert over here and he's all like, yeah, oh, you know, this, that, and the other. And they're like, wow, that's a lot of information.
She was really happy that you knew as much as you did.
Good.
Very happy.
Well, cool.
Came to the right place, PSE.
And Dave was really nice. While they were still setting up, and he came in, he hung out in the office with us and talked to all of us for about 20 minutes, and Scott even longer than that, talking about all kinds of stuff. Jessica brought out some stamps she'd remembered to show him real quick. One of them, we got a K18A. Is that the double overprint?
K16A.
K16A.
You have a double.
And then
nice one.
A used 298 invert, I think. And we showed it to him, going, yeah, these are really expensive, you know, tens of thousands of dollars.
That would be a 296 specimen.
Well,
not at the time.
That's, 296A specimen.
That was the afterthought that Tom said. Of,
they looked really nice. They were all fake.
Tom went.
Were they really?
No. Tom, no. It was just they covered the specimen with a cancel.
Oh, they fake.
But it was submitted. It was submitted properly as a specimen stamp.
With a fake cancel.
Well, they
but
didn't,
that's a conclusion.
Well, they just used specimen stamp.
No, they could use a specimen.
A cancel added.
It did go back with an opinion that the cancel was fake, yes.
Okay. Fake, yeah.
Yeah, because Tom said not only were they expensive stamps, but it was a learning opportunity because since the specimen had been covered over, and he said he thought that the double overprint, that something was sitting on top of the cancel, that the ink was stacked
was
in the wrong order.
The second overprint.
Was that not real also?
No, that one was good.
Okay. Very rare.
Storage Wars.
Sorry.
Oh, back to Storage Wars. Okay. Anyway, so we showed him these stamps, and he was rather impressed.
He said that they find lots of stamps in lockers and no one knows what to do with them.
Now they do.
Yep.
Now they do.
Now they come back and maybe we'll get on the air more.
Maybe.
Hey,
especially
nice
since you gave
regular.
Them such a high value. So maybe that kind of opened their eyes that there may be value there. But wait till next time they bring you something and it's a dud.
Well, the thing is with these three cartons, it wasn't even the main collection. This is the things that the guy never got to. So his wife probably said, me or the stamps. So he put them in the storage unit, and thus they sat for 50 years. I mean, they were dated 1963 on the envelopes. So it's like when things start coming rapidly, like these subscription first day covers, you don't have time to open them. And off in the corner they go, and they pile up, and all of a sudden you have too many, and you can't get to them. And we have to investigate, and hopefully they'll come up with more collections or actual albums.
Yeah, I think that guy really has to. You know, it's not like they cordially sit in a somewhere and just kindly bid. You know, you kind of have to be.
No, they're gregarious about.
Yeah, you gotta. You're in it to win it. It's not some kind of.
Oh, that was
popularity contest.
It's an entertainment program.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Well, the funny
rest
thing,
of it is just kind of a backdrop.
The funny thing is, they put everything on my conference table here, and my office is all nice and clean. Mm. And they said, no, we need this to look stampy. And they went out and they grabbed just stuff. And yeah, they piled it on the table.
Yeah, yeah. Sarah came into my office and said, oh, this would be great. She loved the way my office looks because there was stuff everywhere.
Stuff. And just,
books everywhere. And she loved that.
So everything that was on the desk was, or on the table was just, they grabbed it from someplace.
Yeah, most of it came from my room.
Yeah, I want to see.
That's cool.
I want to see how it looks on TV. Because some of the stuff on the desk was actually pretty interesting looking.
Yeah. I wanted to buy the Canadian revenues.
They're done shooting. Hey, Dave, can I buy something off of you?
Oh, no. The price is going to be too much now. I've seen it on TV.
You did it to yourself.
Ow.
I will remember the next time.
You just shot yourself in the foot.
Yep.
That's okay.
Now, just on that note, and then we'll wrap it up. Jessica and I went home that night and watched a few Storage Wars episodes. And first off, they really make Dave out to look like a jerk, like a lot. And the other thing we noticed that was really subtle that was funny, that thing of dressing a set the way they do, we started noticing that they do that all the time. Because we started looking, they took something, and I think it was something that Dave took too, wasn't it? But somebody taking something to be appraised, and it was, you could tell in the background, it was this big empty warehouse, and they just clustered some tables around the back, and they put like interesting stuff on the table, but you could see the empty warehouse all around them. it was funny.
It was a Chinese appraisal. They put like samurais in the background.
Oh yeah.
And stuff, but the rest of the room was bare.
Yep.
And I'm going, oh, I bet you they put those there.
Now we know.
Okay, on that note, we're going to wrap up this segment.
Yep.
Yep.
So, not only did Storage Wars air last night, but on Jeopardy, there was a question about which famous singers have appeared in postage stamps. So, it's a big night for stamp collecting in general.
Huh? Yeah. What?
Yeah.
What?
Jeopardy.
I missed that on Jeopardy.
No, but what
was
the question?
Was that a category or a single question?
No, it's a category.
Oh.
Singers on stamps?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Nice.
There's been a lot.
It was funny because USPS, I tweeted at them about the Storage Wars, and they tweeted back at me saying, yup.
Yeah, Steve did really well on it. Did you guys see? Well, everybody here saw the episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
I barely saw it. I got the text late that it was on, but I plan on watching it tonight because I re-recorded it because it played again in the middle of the day or middle of the night, like 1:30 in the morning.
Well, spoiler alert, he found some stamps.
I heard. He was here, I remember.
And they were worth some money.
And Steve...
I actually believe he won the show because mm-hmm. of them.
Yes,
last
yes,
night.
He did. He did.
That's what I heard.
But the they edited it rather selectively.
They did.
Well, of course they did.
But I mean, they did a good job. They made Steve look a little weird. And
they did.
And then
look a little weird.
Yeah. And then Dave came out and said, "This guy is obnoxious. I think I got a friend." So everybody who's listening who doesn't know Steve, he's much nicer than is on the and much more on the ball than.
Well, he's been on the podcast before.
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
but this is the first time people see him.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. That's our Steve.
Yeah, we've actually had a couple of requests. Why don't we put a microphone or a camera up so that we can stream our discussion on YouTube or something?
We'll get there.
Because we don't want to break it.
Man, we couldn't keep wearing your pajamas to the podcast.
Yeah.
That's right.
Show up in your underwear.
Anyway.
Well, thanks for not showing up in your underwear, Cash.
Yeah.
Some things are best left unseen.
Exactly. But yeah, everybody can see my chicken picture.
True.
So I didn't. Steve didn't say that he found U.S. airmails in there. I was surprised to see that.
Yeah, actually, they didn't show any. They showed one Ryukyu piece, and really, the major value of it was in the Ryukyu stuff.
Hmm.
I mean, just from bulk.
Well, look at it from the producer and editor standpoint. They do not know that.
Oh yeah,
they're clueless.
Well, also, how long were they here recording?
4 hours.
Yeah, hours, and they distilled it down to like. Four or five minutes. But yeah, it was, and in the end, when he goes, how much is it worth? And Steve just says, $4,200. You can tell that was, you know, them saying, okay, give the retail value. It's like, okay. Because he certainly wouldn't have paid $4,200 for it.
No dealer pays full cat.
That's
generally true.
So I don't know if
you're not a dealer very long if you do.
Yeah. Yeah, working on a 0% markup, it's hard to make it up in volume.
Well, not only that, most collectors demand a discount. So
yeah.
It wouldn't be just a zero markup. It'd be a loss.
Yeah.
Do we dare declare the actual true value? Because Steve told me, I don't know if he told you guys, you know, if Dave was to actively go out and sell it, what he would honestly expect to get.
And I thought that Steve was low. He said, what, $300 or
$200? He said about $400.
$400. I think that from what I saw, one of the problems with it was that it was kind of moldy.
Yeah, and I think you really have to take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the they were stored improperly.
Yeah.
Not that they were in otherwise in poor condition, but the mold really makes a difference.
Yes.
And a lot of people won't even touch it and would prefer you don't bring it to a show and share it.
Some of us included.
Yes.
So if it was stored better, like not in a storage locker, which means that it wouldn't have been there and it wouldn't have been here and it wouldn't have been anywhere, you know, maybe it's like $4,200. But when I looked at it, I thought it was well over the $800 mark. So he still, I forget, what did he pay for the locker? $425?
Yeah, somewhere around
I think
there,
it was like $425. And so he doubled up his money pretty easy just on that.
Well, one thing I found interesting about it is I'm pretty sure it's a tip I heard on that same show years ago. The better lockers are the ones that are covered in layers of dust, which that one was. That was the dirtiest, dustiest locker of the night, for sure. Because that means people haven't been in there for years, and nobody's been in there recently to pick out the good stuff and leave the crap.
Yeah.
So they'd been sitting in a locker untouched for who knows how long. Probably the original owner passed away and left all of that weird old stuff in there. He grabbed it, if I remember. He grabbed that locker because he saw some furniture they liked in the front. Some vintage stuff from the 50s and 60s.
Well, that's interesting, too, that he knew the dates, because if you look at the dates on the approval envelopes, they were, I believe the latest one was 1968. And then in 1968 on, it just stops. There's nothing there. And so the guy collected up to 1968 and then never added anything to the boxes.
Makes it better.
Mm.
Because a lot of the more recent, well, the more recent stuff's harder to get a hold of, so it does have value. But there's that period in the 70s and 80s that there was just way too much of it, and it was oversold, and it has very little value now.
What was it? Steve said something really interesting that made me smile. Right at the end, Dave said, so what's this collection worth? And Steve, what did he say? He said, well, it really isn't a collection. It's more of a, what did he call it?
Accumulation.
Yeah, that's boxes of random stamps is an accumulation.
What's my
collection.
Stamp collection worth? Well, it's not a... Well, it's all here. It's like, well, it's not all there.
That would be a huge collection if it was all there.
Oh, he did point out 20-cent Prexy, though, with the rear plate number. And he goes, if this plate number ended in a 6, it would be worth $20,000. Unfortunately,
this isn't it.
This isn't it, yeah. There was some good stamps there, and I'm glad I got a couple of them to put in my collection.
That's because you're a dumpster diver.
Yeah. I go for the provenance.
Mm. Yeah, they just kind of swept up the extras, the extra moldy stuff that they didn't want, threw it in the garbage, and Cash grabs it out of the garbage. Oh, I'm going to soak these in a little bit of peroxide and bleach to kill off all the mold.
Yeah, and it was thick. after the soaking, it still had bleach. Yeah, but it's better than smelling of mold, if I have my preference.
Well, yeah, but...
No, yeah, that was fun. I liked seeing it. I liked seeing our banner in the background.
Well, he introduced it flat out, saying, yeah, I'm going to go to professional stamp experts to get my stamps looked at by an expert.
And then when you look over Dave Hester's, you see my desk or my shelf with all my Chotskys on it. And they took all the Chotskys off because they didn't want to monkey with any licensing or anything like that.
Oh, dear. Yes, there were Legos and World of Warcraft figures.
They didn't want it to look like we had 5-year-old experts.
And Daleks and...
No, we just have Cash.
Hey, I'm a collector of everything, including Daleks and stamps. And Daleks on stamps.
And mold.
And mold. Moldy stamps. So... That was a fun one I got. So I got some souvenirs, and then he signed a book for me. He gave me an autograph on a book and an autograph on a piece of paper.
I have one, too.
I know.
It says, to Jeff, yup, Dave Hester.
Mine says, to Cash, yup, same thing. And then he wrote one, just, to PSE, yup.
He thought that was really cute, because I had to go ask him for that when they were done, right when he was leaving. He was like, it's fine. I felt like a little kid. It was like, excuse me, but my boss asked if you could do one more. Which, I hate to say it, I don't mean to burst everybody's opinionated bubble, but Dave's not the nasty guy they make him out to be, as far as I'm concerned. No. He's a goofball, in a good way, but they really villainized the heck out of him this season.
Well, not so much on that one, although... That one was funny when Jared and Brandy backed into the pole.
That was funny.
I think my brother does kind of the same thing to get on his opponent's nerves when we're playing board games like that. He knows they've had to poke you. Yeah. So it gets you off your game.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they really... What's the German guy's name? Chubby German guy.
Yeah.
But they made it out like Dave and him are just like bitter enemies. And the auctioneer and his wife act like they hate his guts.
Yeah.
That's not how it started out. He was annoying when it started out, but that's different.
I think he was annoying in the beginning because they said, we need a replacement for Dave. And the only person who I really miss on the show is Barry.
Oh, yeah.
If anybody from Storage Wars is listening, get Barry back on the show.
Please.
Please, yes.
Oh, no, my wife hated Barry.
Oh, he was the...
She hated him because he would go through a locker and he'd pick out one thing and leave the entire locker there and just say, throw it all away. And that just annoyed the crap out of her. Even if it was... And he would throw... actually nice looking furniture, and he would just throw it around and drop things that is like, dude, that stuff's actually worth money. What are you doing?
Well, actually, if you read the background on him, he was a friend of the producer.
Well, yeah, I know.
And they just invited him in. He wasn't in the storage industry. He was in the produce industry. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen is he would buy the lockers. He'd do his spiel. And then you'd give the rest to Goodwill or anybody else who would come out and pick it up. So I don't think he actually threw it away. He donated it.
It's like the time they did those, I guess it was 100.
Yeah, but that's not nearly as good of a TV show.
100
yeah.
abandoned storage crates at the shipping
place.
And he just had to buy crate number 100 or something like that.
Oh, yeah. His lucky number or something. I remember that one.
And, of course, it was a box of crap.
Well, he was on the episode, you know, they do repeats. So he was, him and Mark Bolalo were on the episode before the new episode. And it was hard to see Mike Bolalo live again because he passed away mid-season, I think.
Well, the, yeah, well.
Did not know that.
Didn't know that
either. Which one was he? I don't know.
Yeah, they didn't even dedicate an episode to him or anything. He just kind of passed out of the storyline.
Mark was maybe in a half a dozen episodes. He was kind of the suave-looking guy with the European accent, with the fanny pack stuffed full of cash.
Yeah, he'd come out and pull out a wad of $100 bills and go, oh, I'm here to do whatever I'm going to do.
His biggest faux pas is he thought he'd like hit the jackpot with an original Nintendo that he found that he thought was Series 1.
Really?
And he made this big deal out of it. Oh, this is going to be worth so much money. He went to take it down. Yeah, no, that's not Series 1. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's like a, give me $20 for it.
No, yeah, I think it was much. 45.
But 45.
He, yeah, he was 45 one of those guys that walked in with a wad of cash and figured he could buy everything.
Yeah.
He'd wear silk shirts.
Yeah.
Unbuttoned down to, like, between his pecs. He was that kind of guy.
Oh, well.
I still enjoy the show. I'm glad it's still running. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that Dave is back.
Hey, listeners, we have a special bonus. We set up our podcast at Ameristamp Expo 2015 in Riverside, California. And the following are the interviews that I collected over the course of the show. Don't mind the background noise. It comes and it goes, but that's part of a live cast. So, enjoy. I'm sitting here with Michael Bloom of the Stamp Buddy Service, and he's going to explain a little bit about what he does.
Well, first of all, good morning, and thank you for asking me to be here. The Stamp Buddy Service began as a response to a young lady, Lisa, who wrote a letter to the editor, which appeared in the American Philatelist. The letter basically said that she had gone to a stamp show, and she's a beginner. She went to visit with the dealer, she spoke with the dealer, and toward the end of the conversation, the dealer turned to her and said, you're not a collector, you're a hoarder. And Lisa wrote that letter to the editor. I, amongst others, read the letter and was rather upset by it. If this is the public face of our hobby, we're in trouble. So I wrote a letter back to the American Philatelist, which was published. Suggesting that we have some sort of new program to mentor people into our hobby. After giving it some thought, I came to the conclusion that while letters to the editor are very nice to do, they don't necessarily result in action. So I took the next step, which was to write to the board, to every individual member of the APS board, saying, at your next meeting, I'd be happy to appear before you, and here's the general outline of a program I suggest. And perhaps we need to mentor or buddy people into our hobby. I appeared before the board. The board was very excited, very enthusiastic, and said, it's a great idea. Why don't you lead it?
Oh.
And that's why to this day I'm the chairman of the Stamp Buddy Service Committee. The basic idea of Stamp Buddy is to present a welcoming face to our hobby, and hopefully to bring new people into our hobby. The way it's worked is we now have two phases. Our first phase, or first part, has to do with stamp shows. We began with the two major APS stamp shows, Ameristamp Expo and Stamp Show. And at these shows, we set up a booth, and we have a strategy for bringing new people into our hobby. And the strategy is basically this. We get to know people. They come to our booth. We have discussions about their lives, their interests, why they're at the show, their ethnic background, generations back, and their other hobbies. And we sort of hold that inside for a moment. We invite them over to our booth to sit down with a bucket of stamps, and we ask them to choose as many as they like with no limit. Pick the stamps that look interesting to you. After they do that, we project the stamps onto a screen and onto a laptop. They're looking at the laptop while the rest of the passersby are looking at the screen. Each stamp they choose, we kind of provide information coming back to them. We sort of narrate what that stamp is. And we do it interactively. We'll say, for example, well, where do you think this stamp is from? How old do you think it is? What's the theme of the stamp? And that sort of thing. We'll point to parts of the stamp and say, well, what do you think that means? Why is there a name Waterlow and Sons across the bottom? What do you think? Who do you think Waterlow was? We get them involved. If it's an historic stamp, to the extent that the presenter, the buddy, the mentor, rather, knows about the history, we'll talk about the history or the science or whatever. And at the end of that, we hand the guests a glassine envelope, and those stamps become theirs. Next, we often do tours of the show floor, showing them what dealers are, how they work. When back at the booth, we give a little Stamps 101 presentation on things like what are perforations, what are watermarks, why do some countries no longer exist, why do we still have their stamps. Then where do you store stamps? How do you show stamps? We talk about things like catalogs, how to make your own albums using desktop publishing. It's brief. It's surface only. We're not looking for depth. We're looking for interest and excitement. Sometimes the next part, if there's interest expressed, then we help that person decide what to collect. That's the culmination, in a way, of what we've done so far. So, for example, one gentleman had some background in Africa, also in France and French. They decided they'd collect French Morocco. So we gave them an assignment. Walk around the show and buy some French Moroccan stamps and then come back to us. Show us what you bought. So it's a way of encouraging that kind of activity. One of the side benefits is that we also promote membership in the APS. And we've actually been quite successful. For example, over the course of 1 year, the program incidentally brought in over 100 new APS members. Now, we started with the two major APS shows, and there are approximately 30-some-odd shows in the next tier, which are called the World Series of Philately shows. Those are regional shows throughout the United States, and we've made good inroads. In fact, right now, we're in 8 of about 30 of those shows. And at this show, at Ameristamp Expo, the APS board has agreed to provide us with hired help back at Bellefonte to coordinate the Stamp Buddy program. So one of the things they're going to be doing is this coordination with shows. The other part of what we do is outreach to non-collectors, specifically non-collecting adults, because there are other programs that deal with youth. The outreach program here looks to find demographics that we're not serving, that don't, that potentially have lots of collectors for us, but we may not be reaching. And we look for certain characteristics of the individuals who are within those venues. Typically, they're people who have time, they have some discretionary income. They're intellectually curious by the groups they belong to. We sort of know that. They tend to be interested in current events and history. So we prepare PowerPoint presentations, one of which, for example, is on senior living, and that's to be used at senior living facilities and assisted living. We have one on genealogical philately. And so what we do is our committee, which consists of some really incredible people, including Ken Martin, Gretchen Moody, the director of education at APS, and some other luminaries, we decide which population we want to work on first. For example, now we're working on genealogical philately. So what we do is the committee asks that new person who's coming on board to find speaking opportunities in genealogical societies scattered throughout the United States. That person makes the call, explains what we'd like to present, and determines whether or not there's interest in having someone come and do the presentation. If there is, then we do an email blast locally to the areas surrounding that venue, asking APS members if they'd like to volunteer to be a presenter. That's also a way of getting our own APS members involved more in outreach and in the hobby to personalize it for them as well. So, for example, with genealogical philately, depending upon where that's given, the presenter can customize the PowerPoint to include letters and envelopes and stamps about that particular region. After the presentation, the presenter hopefully will have stirred enough interest to gather a group together to begin their stamp collecting adventure. And that's how we bring new people into the hobby. So those are the two programs that we do. We're about 2.5 years old, and we're moving forward.
So how might someone get in contact with you if they want to donate or volunteer?
Okay. We have a page on the APS website. The direct way of getting there would be www.stamps.org/StampBuddy. That's the easiest way to get in touch with us. As far as donations, you can donate directly to the program by specifying to the APS that that's where you want your donation to go. In general, even if you don't, the APS has been very generous in donating materials to us, in donating time to us, and their own enthusiasm.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time and information about Stamp Buddy. I look forward to seeing you in future shows.
Again, thank you, and enjoy the show.
All right, I'm sitting here with members of the Young Philatelic Leaders Fellowship. You guys mind introducing yourselves?
Hi, my name is Ethan Chu, and I'm the current fellow for the class of 2015, and I'm doing the exhibitor track.
All right.
And my name is Charles Epting. I'm the senior fellow for the class of 2015, and I'm doing the author track for the fellowship.
I am 15 years old.
And I'm 21.
How did you get into stamp collecting?
So in eighth grade, my dad showed me his grandfather's stamp collection, and I looked at all the stamps, and they were wrapped in these cellophane tape that were removable, and once I revealed them, I saw the beauty of the stamps, so I did a lot of research around that, and ever since, I've been hooked around Hong Kong stamps.
And I've always been a bit of a history buff my entire life, collecting bits and pieces of really anything I can find. So a couple of years ago, it was just a natural progression to make into stamp collecting. The fact that I could hold a piece of the 1920s or 30s in my hand relatively inexpensive was it didn't take up much room and didn't take up much of my budget, which were both important as a college student. So it just seemed like a natural extension of my love for history.
Excellent. Could you, one of you, tell me a little bit about your association, how it started, what you guys do?
Yeah, the YPLF, the Young Philatelic Leaders Fellowship, started a couple of years ago. It's part of the APS, and a couple of the younger members thought it was important for there to be a program to welcome philatelists between the age of 13 and 25 into the hobby, to give them the resources to go to the APS shows over the course of a year-long cycle. And just through that, it's sort of a fully immersive, hands-on experience for young philatelists to really become part of the hobby, to not feel like an outsider. There's obviously people here who have been collecting much longer than Ethan and I have even been alive. So this really helps us meet the right people, learn the tools of the trade, and learn techniques and things that don't make us feel like outsiders, make us really feel like a part of the community.
What made each of you pick the track that you chose?
So for me, exhibiting was really interesting. So they had three people come in in August to explain each tract. And the person that came in for exhibiting was Janet Hauser. And she talked about her exhibiting experience and how fun it is to talk to the dealers and find the stamps that she's exhibiting and tell a compelling story and get people more interested in stamps. So that's what hooked me to do exhibiting.
And I chose author because I'm a history student planning on going to graduate school next year. And I've written a couple of books and articles and things, not about stamps, but about history at large. And it just seemed like a natural progression to sort of try and get my name out there in the philatelic world and start getting published in some of the key magazines and newspapers and things. So for me, it was just a natural extension of what I'd be doing in my free time anyways to hone in on philately.
All right, wonderful. So you guys have some mentors, it sounds like, then?
We do. My for the author track, my mentor is John Hotchner, who, okay. as a stamp historian and writer and researcher, there's no one else better. And he's really taken me under his wing and been incredible these last couple of months, helping me. My first piece is going to run in the AP in April. So,
oh, wow, congratulations.
Thank you. So to start there, it's going to be hard to go up from there, but John's been incredible so far. Ethan?
So, yeah, my mentor is Jeff Shapiro, and he's been instrumental in the building blocks of my exhibit. Every month we meet to talk about my exhibit and go over it, and he's told me many different helpful tips for making my story as compelling as possible.
What do we do to get more young people into stamps?
It's a tough one, and it's sort of the elephant in the room, anyone you talk to here. I think it's important to not make it... It's sort of the problem with history in general, and something I've faced as a history student, is showing people it's not boring, that it can be a compelling, vibrant, exciting narrative. You know, it's not just old people sitting there flipping through their stamp albums. There's ways to tailor it. If you like baseball, if you like movies, if you like, you know, kittens, whatever it is, there's a way to do it that I think anyone can be interested in stamp collecting. And I think it's really about breaking down these stereotypes that have existed over the decades and centuries even. And I think people like Mark Cuban putting their name out there in the stamp collecting world, I think things like that are important. You know, all my friends, they hear I'm a stamp collector, and there's automatically this image that comes to their mind. But when I show them things from World War II or things that flew on Zeppelins or all kinds of crazy sort of oddball, you know, not your typical stamps in album, I think that's what could really help break down the prejudice and the stereotype against stamp collecting, showing them it's not just for old people, that there's plenty of young people who are just as interested and can really make it exciting. So that's my two cents. Ethan, you, I'm sure you have some insight as well.
Yeah, that's a really difficult question to answer. Well, for me, getting youth interested in philately is super important. And the people I've talked to, especially my cousins who are younger than me, the reason that they're interested in it is because of the history in it. So they're located in Hong Kong, and they collect a lot of recent Hong Kong stamps because each of the stamps tell a story. For example, the Lunar New Year stamp with the animal on top of the animal on the stamp. Forget the animal this year, but each stamp, nevertheless, each stamp tells its story, and it's really interesting to conduct research and to further a hobby through that. And also, in addition to that, a lot of people I've talked to that are interested in stamps also are interested in earning money and like getting a first step towards business and like selling on eBay and buying on eBay. That's another aspect of philately that people do.
You can start out small. You can work on it. As I say, you guys do know money's in the dealer track, right?
Yeah. It's the kind of thing. It's a labor, at least for me, it's a labor of love. It's not, I'm not looking at them as investments. I'm not looking at them as something to sell off in the future. It's what I find that makes me happy and pass it on to my kids someday, hopefully. Yeah,
exactly. What I find really awesome about philately is because it's so affordable. It's such an affordable hobby. You can find a used stamp for like 1 cent. You can just buy anything with just $5 in your hand. And you can even make an exhibit with only $5 in your hand and create a compelling story with that. So that's what I found really awesome about philately. You can do anything with it.
All right. Is there contact information for your association?
Contact information for the YPLF can be found on the APS website, stamps.org. Under the Youth tab, I believe, there's a link, information, application for the YPLF, any questions you might have about the organization and its history and its program. So all through stamps.org.
And there's also a YPLF Facebook page if you want to look at the posts that they have done in the past, too.
All right, cool. Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate you taking 10 minutes out to get this interview done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here with Gregory Slaughter. He's from ESPER, the Ebony Society of Philatelic Events and Reflections. He's going to tell us a little bit about his group.
Well, ESPER is an organization that promotes an interest in the study and collecting of stamps honoring African Americans and related subjects in the United States and foreign philatelic materials. Oh, I'll just say that we have an active educational program in our organization. We promote our organization through philatelic clubs and schools and churches throughout the nation.
So Black History Month must be quite an event for you guys, because when they do the releases for the Black History icons.
Well, yeah, I've done several seminars for different organizations on Black history through stamps in the United States. But I look at it like this. There's really no Black History Month in the nation. It's a Black History Year because we're all Americans. And we all bleed the same color, blood. I served in the military. And, so I look at it as part of the American experience.
How might someone get in touch with you so that they can learn more or join your organization?
Well, I am the only West Coast officer on the board of directors in ESPER. We have a web page, and I will give you the website as soon as I look it up myself. It's www.espers.org should be our website. And also you can contact me locally by email at gsnet1@verizon.net, and just make an attention, Gregory Slaughter or ESPER, and I will get back with you and give you additional information.
Okay, and what's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
Well, when I was very young, and that had to be a half a century ago, I did collect basic stamps, and I remember collecting them. But my change came around 1986 because I always had an interest in the space program. My father worked in the aerospace industry, and he was working on the XB-70 jet aircraft at the time, which was cutting-edge technology. And that led to an interest in the space program. But the company he worked for also built the Apollo capsule. And so I had a deep interest in the space program. And in 1986, I learned about space covers. And it turned out that the city of Downey, California, at the Downey Post Office, was one of the locations in the nation that had a pictorial postmark for the launch of our space shuttles. The other was in the Kennedy Space Center, and the third one was at the Houston Space Center. Then they had the Goddard Space Club and the JPL Stamp Club. But it was close at home in Downey. And so I went and got my very first space cover, and everything took off from there. And that led to down the road, looking around saying, wow, there's Black people on stamps in this nation. And that led to me joining ESPER and learning a lot more.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate the new information.
Jessica, thank you. It's an honor being here.
Okay, I'm sitting here with Liz Heisey of Women Exhibitors, and she's going to tell us a little bit about what she does.
We started Women Exhibitors here in Riverside in 2007. It was a suggestion from one of our other stamp exhibitors that there was nothing really for women. We were finding that a lot of the women were being intimidated by their husbands. It was rather like a husband trying to teach his wife how to drive. I mean, there's always flare-ups and stuff. So we decided to start a mentoring group called Women Exhibitors. And so we had a meeting here in 2007. We started off with 13 members. We came up with a mission statement and a logo, and we are now up to about 120 members. We meet suddenly here in at the Ameristamp show. We also meet in the general summer show. And then we try and have meetings at various stamp shows around the country if we have somebody there who's willing to have one. We support each other. We help each other by mentoring exhibitors. We help newcomers to join the exhibiting. We've had four symposiums. We had one in 2009 in Bellefont at the APS Center. We had one in Denver. In concurrence with the Denver show, we had one in Portland, and we just had one in St. Louis last year.
Yeah, I can definitely testify to you. When you see the final product of an exhibit and see all the work that went into it, it's very intimidating to think, wow, and see all the rules that they post, you know, on
not
the floor.
Not rules, and, or, guidelines.
Oh, sorry, guidelines.
Guidelines.
it's very intimidating.
It's intimidating in, I mean, we're trying to, my type of exhibiting is not what I call traditional. I don't do old stamp, classic stamps or postal history. I do fun things like illustrated mail, or I have an exhibit on the floor on prexies, but they're not on covers. They're on boxes and labels and tags, and just to try and say that, you know, it doesn't have to be serious. I mean, it's a hobby. We should be having fun at this.
I saw the cockroach exhibit.
Isn't that good? That's one of our success stories. Jean was a novice at St. Louis last year. It was her first time exhibiting. And it's a fabulous exhibit. It's totally off the wall. But she's done very well. I mean, she normally gets a Vermeer. She got a silver here, but she's expanded it a bit, and so she's lost a little focus. But mostly, so she's a new one. We had another lady who started. She's an artist. Her husband was a stamp collector, and she decided that she needed to join as well. So she did a whole life of called Gertrude, The Life and Times of Gertrude, and it's all about Gertrude being born and becoming an artist and doing things around the country, and it's, and then she won the best of most popular here last year. So at Ameristamp, not necessarily in Riverside, because we move around all the country.
Is there a certain level of you said you help novices, just help the youth, or is it just?
We mostly concentrate on women. There are a lot of, you know, the youth have their own section and their own mentors, so we mostly do women. You were mentioning my pin. It's an award that we give to an exhibitor who gets a silver or below, so as an encouragement. And it's actually open to men and women, so we have a lot of men who have them. In fact, I think my husband and I are the only ones who have, the only couple who actually have both of them, because my husband's an exhibitor too. So it's good.
So how might someone get in touch with you to find out more about your organization?
If they want to get in touch with me, they can either go to the AAP website, which is www.aap.org, and click on the Wee button.
Do you have an email?
Yes, lizheidi@gmail.com. But mostly if they go onto the AAP website, they can click on us and they can find a lot of information about us. We're basically an internet organization, except we do have meetings. We have a quarterly newsletter that goes out by email, unless we do have a few snail mails, but mostly it's all internet.
What's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
Well, that's very easy. I didn't start stamp collecting until 1999. My husband came into my office one day and said, "No, China rabbits take up too much space. Why don't you start collecting rabbits on stamps? And here's a stock book, and it'll take you 10 years to do it." And I said, "Well, why not?" Then I found out about exhibiting, and I started exhibiting. And then I said, "Well, the hobby's been very good to me. Why don't I give back?" So I trained to become a judge. And now I'm a chief judge and judge stamp shows. I'm going home tomorrow, flying out on Thursday to Phoenix to judge a show there. So it's so my earliest memories is not long ago.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sweetie.
I'm here with James Wygant of the Young Philatelic Leaders Fellowship. And he's going to tell us a little bit about what makes his group special.
Well, I'm on the advisory board for the Young Philatelic Leaders Fellowship, and that's a group that's for extra motivated young collectors in their teens and early 20s. It's been in existence since 2009. And it's a great way to get young, really young people more involved with the hobby. I grew up in Oklahoma, and whenever I go to my local shows in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, Oklahoma City, it was always in a gymnasium, you know, with 10 or 15 dealers. I'd walk in. I had fun, and I would talk to people, but I was usually the only young person there. Back in 2011, I went to my first big stamp show, summer APS stamp show. And so this, you know, 20-something kid from Oklahoma walks in and used to 10 or 15 dealers in a gymnasium, and I walk into 150 dealers at up in Ohio, and I was just like deer in the headlights, you know. But I had a great time, but I was fortunate enough when I was there, I met a couple of young collectors, and I had never, ever been around someone my age, and it was amazing the time we had, just because nothing against the older crowd. I mean, they're source of knowledge and expertise and friendship, but when you can share what you're doing with somebody who's around your own age, you just get each other and you have so much fun. So at that point I met Alex Hyman, and he and I became very good friends, and I thought I would go to the big summer shows, you know, once every 5 years or something like that. I was hooked because I finally had some other friends. And I've made some more friends my age in subsequent shows. And we were up at Garfield Perry, and there was four of us together in a room. And we're like, oh, wow, four young guys. You know, this is so much fun. And it got us thinking, you know, if there's four of us, there's got to be tons and tons of other people, the 20-something from Oklahoma doing it by himself, that if they just had the option to be around other people, they would have a really a deeper and more involved relationship with the hobby and have a lot of fun. So we got with the APS, and they sent out a mailing to everyone in the APS over the age of 20 and under the age of 50. And it was 1,600 people that we mailed this to. And it said, you know, we're looking to start a social alliance of young collectors, and we're hoping to have an event in Hartford, Connecticut in 2014. And if you're interested, contact James Weigant. So then I found the definition of your email box exploding because, you know, 1,600 people got this mailing. So a lot of people said, you know, this is great. I thought I was the only one. I've made a lot of Facebook friends. A lot of people couldn't make it because of family and job commitments and things like that. But in Hartford, we had our first event, and we had 30 people at dinner. A lot of collectors came out of the woodwork, very involved, young people. It was exciting. There's famous Brandon Nugent, who had given up on going on shows altogether, and he works for the State Department and flew from Bosnia to come to our show to hang out with other young collectors. The group... The purpose of the group is to just sort of replicate what happened to me and my few friends to as many people as we possibly can. You know, it's to have that social interaction, to become more involved. You know, before I met Alex and these other young people, I didn't exhibit, I didn't write, I didn't volunteer with the APS. And now that it's become such a big part of my life, I want to really get involved. And I think if other people had the support that I've had, we'd have more writers and exhibitors and volunteers. The big focus is just to have fun. There's also a second prong to it. You know, it is for people under the age of 50, but, you know, in 20 years, our group is going to be the APS, you know? And so we're going to be tasked with taking the society and the hobby forward, and we might as well do it as a tight-knit group of friends rather than just a collection of strangers. And that's what the group's trying to accomplish, and have a lot of fun while we're doing it. We had our second event here in Riverside. We had dinner Friday night, and we had a show-and-tell yesterday on Saturday in the afternoon. We have a good turnout again. Next event will be in Grand Rapids, Michigan for a stamp show in the summer of 2015. We have a Facebook page, just forward slash Y YFAPS, for Young Friends of the American Philatelic Society. That's our group, what we've named the group is that, and versus the Young Philatelic Leaders Fellowship, which is for, you know, kids, teenagers, and early teens. The Young Friends of the American Philatelic Society is for everyone over the age of 20, under the age of 50. Ken Martin joined our group. He turned 50 the Saturday of Stamp Show, so he timed out. But what we've done is, even if you do turn 50, if you were under the age of 50 the summer of 2014, you will always be part of the group. Everyone will eventually, as they get older, will transition over into the what we just call the alumni group, where, because again, eventually I'll be 50 and we'll be the American Philatelic Society. We're always going to keep the group together, you know.
What's your earliest memory of stamp collecting?
Earliest memory of stamp collecting. Well, in my family, history was always important, and the history of things, you know. I have my great-grandfather's teacup. He was an Osage Indian. It's a gigantic teacup. It's comical how huge it is. But I was always told, that's your great-grandfather's teacup. And on the open market, it's worth nothing. But to our family, it's priceless, you know. So that history was always important. And then I remember specifically whenever I started collecting, it was February of 1991 when the postal rate changed from 25 to 29 cents. This collector in my small hometown of Pawhuska, Oklahoma, started mailing in his bills to my parents' pharmacy using what I thought were these really old, really cool, probably really expensive 4-cent stamps from the late 50s, early 60s. And I was like, wow, look at the engraving and these little tiny pieces of art. And I asked Mr. Ross, I was like, hey, can I trade you new stamps for the old stamps? And he just, you know, shook his head and realized this kid doesn't know everything, so it took me under his wing, showed me the basics, gave me a stock book and a bunch of 4-cent, you know, plate blocks that I still use on my mail to this day. Took me under his wing, and I've been collecting ever since, straight through, and I'm 36 years old now. So,
thank you.
So, what do you collect specifically?
People think I'm crazy, and I've had collectors tell me that if they had to do it the way I do it, they wouldn't even do it. I pick tiny little areas and focus on it and try to get as complete as I can. I collect U.S. stamps, but it's just commemoratives from 1898 to 1950. It's just airmail stamps, and it's just the fourth bureaus, the 1922 definitives. But my big focus is the postal history of Osage County, Oklahoma. So it's just one of 77 counties in Oklahoma. If it's Oklahoma postal history and it's from Tulsa or Oklahoma City, I don't care. It's got to be just Osage County. I exhibit that, and I've written an article about it as well. And then I also collect the postal history around the Philmont Boy Scout Ranch in New Mexico, which is even more focused and really ticks off some dealers whenever I say I need New Mexico. And they're like, well, what county? And I'm like, well, Colfax County. And it's like, oh, here's Colfax County. It's like, no, well, I need the southwest corner of Colfax County, one of, you know, 14 post offices. But I still find this stuff here at Stamp Show. Here in Riverside, I found 4 Osage County items and 1 New Mexico item. So I still find it. It's the needle in the haystack. But whenever I do find something, you know, it's like, yes.
So how might people find out more information about your group?
If you'd like to know more about the group, we've got our Facebook page that you can go check out. You can contact me directly at jameswiegant@sbcglobal.net. That's jameswiegant@sbcglobal.net. And then you can also just, you know, contact the, if you just wanted to contact the APS and say, tell me more about it, they can handle it also.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Sure, it's been fun.
What else you got, Jessica?
Okay, we're going to do the Jenny Sheet next.
Oh, yay. Drum, we still haven't found one.
Oh, I have a funny feeling this is the one.
Bite me. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I have a Bite Me Valentine, and also a new motto, every zoo is a petting zoo if you try hard enough.
Yeah, that's actually funny.
I know.
Yeah. And card. Nothing empty on the card, so even without seeing the sheet, I know it's going to be a normal. And it is. $12 postage. Yay! Yay.
Okay, you can email us at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, Facebook, stampshowheretoday, and our website, www.stampshowheretoday.com, with your questions and comments. You can now leave your questions and comments on our Google Voice answering machine anytime. Nobody will pick it up. It's just a digital answering machine at 1-949-873-4298. There's also a link on Google Voice on our website, so you can make a call from any computer. And keep collecting.
I'm James Wygant, Associate Editor of the American Stamp Dealer and Collector, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today. She wrote upon a pizza to send up.